Hey, I'm here.
It's the show. Let me make some microphone noise for you there and move this around like that a little bit.
Hey, man, how are y'all doing? All right, well, good. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sorry for ducking out on you yesterday. Had a thing came up I had to take care of. But, yeah, everything's fine. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Will Grigg and Trita Parsi. Today's show, Will Grigg, Trita Parsi. And, you know, I'm having email troubles. But I'm working on a couple of more, and I'll continue working on a couple of more guests during the break here. God, I get so much spam. Drive me crazy, dude. Yeah. Oops. I didn't mean to delete that. All right. Well, anyway, let's see. Move on. Click that. Move to inbox. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Will Grigg is going to be on. Will Grigg, he's the best at talking about things. Generally speaking. But specifically, he's speaking about the cops. So many cop stories to talk about. And so much great writing at Will Grigg's blog. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. He's such a talented writer and, he's as well-spoken as he is good at writing, too. So, that's a real good mix of things, right? Perfectly libertarian. Best writer. Most eloquent speaker in the libertarian movement. The heroic William Norman Grigg. Oh, and he's got his priorities straight. He's not just a perfect libertarian. He cares about the most important stuff first and the least important stuff last, which is kind of important to me. And we need people to write about demunicipalizing garbage service. It's important to do that, but it's just not as important as the stuff Will writes about. So anyway, and then Trita Parsi is going to be on, and we're going to talk about the chances for a final stage nuclear deal with Iran and whether the Hawks are going to be able to prevent the nuclear deal. Boy, if Barack Obama can't get this deal done, then he will have accomplished nothing other than to make healthcare in America worse than before, which is pretty bad. But in terms of foreign policy, this will be the only thing he can claim as an achievement. He used to like to claim he ended the Iraq War, but sorry, that's kind of no longer relevant. He's going to be pulling combat troops out of Afghanistan, but the ones he leaves behind, they're going to be in combat. So, you know, I don't know. I guess I do know, man. I talked to Anand Gopal about this stuff on the show last week or 2 weeks ago, and he knows, and he told me. He's at least skeptical that this government can last without the United States at all. Of course, it's going to take the United States at least air power to prop up the government there. That's why Obama signed a deal to stay till 2024 in Afghanistan. So, no victory there. The surge didn't work there. No one's even pretending the surge worked there. Thankfully, no one cared to ask whether it worked or not. Nobody cared at all by the time it was done failing. But anyway, Obama has nothing to claim for a foreign policy victory other than possibly this nuclear deal with Iran. And if the Republicans are able to to thwart him on this, then he's the biggest loser ever to be the president ever. And he may already be the biggest loser ever to be the president. I mean, he did get reelected. But, well, that's just the power of incumbency in this day and age. I think he can do it. Here's why I think he can do it. There is no crisis at all. They never were making nukes. Their entire nuclear program is already completely and totally safeguarded by the IAEA, which has always continued to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. The whole scandal was that they must have a secret facility somewhere, except that wasn't true. It never was true. There never were any secret facilities. Just forget about it. There's everything that they got. And they couldn't begin making a nuke with everything that everybody already knows that they have unless they withdrew from the non-proliferation treaty and kicked the inspectors out of the country and declared to the world that they were going to begin making nukes now, which is absolutely inconceivable. There's no way that's going to happen. And if it was going to happen, the Americans and or Israelis would have plenty of time to go ahead and bomb them then, which is all the people who don't want a nuclear deal want to do now. Never mind that Iran's a sovereign state. They can withdraw from the treaty if they want to. They can make nukes if they want to. They've got more of a right to make nukes than America does. The USA is the only country that ever used them. Unnecessarily, I might add. Against towns full of, they knew, nothing but civilians. Oh, and in the case of Nagasaki, American POWs, I might add. And Iran is surrounded by nuclear powers. And ones that they don't get along with. Pakistan, Israel, America, they kind of get along with Russia. And, of course, America's in the Indian Ocean there. That's an American lake. You can call it the Indian Ocean if you want, but it's just American Lake 3, whatever, something like that. Anyway, so they never were making nukes. So all Obama has to do is just sign a deal that has them basically promise to sign the additional protocol to their safeguards agreement, which would allow for expanded inspections, increased inspection times, and they're quibbling about which of their centrifuges, should they leave them running or should they leave them unplugged. You don't have to dismantle them, but at least don't have them working. Don't have them all the way put together. You know, these kinds of things they're quibbling over. In other words, the deal is right there ready to be done. It's Obama's deal to blow. Now, in favor of a nuclear deal with Iran is the fact that Obama's, this is the only thing he'll be able to claim credit for in his entire presidency in terms of foreign policy. He really needs this. And he's shown that he's willing to fight for it a little bit when he has to. He said in the State of the Union speech last January, "Hey Congress, shut the F up. No, you're not going to pass new sanctions, and if you do pass them, I'll veto them anyway. So just back off." I'm roughly paraphrasing. It was the toughest guy thing he ever did. And they backed down. And he got very hawkish Democrats to say, well, hell, man, I am an American, not an Israeli. And I am a Democrat, and he's the leader of the Democratic Party, and he wants my support on this, and I'm in the Congress. That's my job. Including Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is a very hawkish pro-Israel Democrat from Florida, who was savagely attacked as being like a stooge of Iran and the terrorists for daring to stand with the president on this one. And I think, you know, that actually probably blew up in their face a little bit because she got kind of offended. That's an accusation for her to make against others. So, you know, they call her anti-Semitic and stuff. I'm not supposed to call her that. So anyway, I think he can do it. I think Trita thinks he can do it. But anyway, he'll be on the show later, too. And that's how I waste the first segment of the show every day, is telling you what's going to be on the show later. Good stuff on the other side of this break. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Live in La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Again, Will Grigg, Tree to Parsi coming up. Oh, man. Forgot I need to double check on that. All right, so lots of stuff to talk about on the show today and a lot of stuff left over from yesterday that I didn't get to because, you know, I didn't get to anything. So here's from my Afghanistan section here. Hope you're looking at antiwar.com every day, right? Unreal. All right, so, yeah, might as well stick with Afghanistan for a minute. Talked about that in the last segment. And I have some more Afghanistan stories here somewhere. Where's my Afghanistan section? Well, I guess this will be plenty. Senate roadmap to keep billions flowing into Afghanistan. Senate Democrats seek to make additional aid condition-based. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com from yesterday. A new Senate Foreign Relations Committee report lays out their roadmap for continuing to pour billions of dollars in aid into Afghanistan annually. $5 to $8 billion? Hell, it's going to take a lot more than that. I don't know. I guess this part of the problem of not having an adversarial media at all is that no one has really asked these generals to explain how 10 or 20,000 American soldiers are supposed to hold Afghanistan together when the whole damn country is just a civil war waiting to break out. It might be 3 or 4 or 5 civil wars waiting to break out at any given time. For example, Taliban kills prosecutors, kidnaps police in latest operations. How stable is your so-called nation state when the resistance fighters can kidnap the police? You know, the people that you call when somebody gets kidnapped. People you better not call if somebody gets kidnapped. If you ever want to see your people again, you know, they'll get them killed. They don't care. What do they care? They don't. Anyway. Taliban kills prosecutors, kidnaps police in latest operation. 4 years after expulsion, Taliban retakes key Uruzgan district, with U.S. and NATO forces increasingly focused on airstrikes and letting the Afghan military do the ground fighting. The Afghan Taliban doesn't get coverage in the Western media it used to. That doesn't mean the group is any less active, however. Taliban forces were active across the country today with a major, this is yesterday's news.antiwar.com, with a major attack on a prosecutor's office in Kunduz, killing 10 people, including 7 prosecutors, and wounding 10 others. I know, I can hear y'all green with envy out there. The attack was retaliation for recent death penalties given to Taliban prisoners. Meanwhile, Taliban forces attacked police in the northeastern Badakhshan province. Kidnapping at least 17 and killing 4 others. An attack on the War Dodge district. Yes, I'm sure that's not how they pronounce it either. I just don't know how to pronounce it. They're also looking to expand their territory, the Taliban is, with an offense, with an offensive in the Uruzgan province's Ghazab district. Ghazab is noteworthy because instead of being ousted by NATO, the locals rose up and chased the Taliban out 4 years ago. Now the Taliban are back in force and have some 80% of the district under their direct control. The Taliban's offensives usually start petering out about this time of the year, as there is virtually no infrastructure in the country, and both sides tend to just shore up defenses during the winter. Whatever the Taliban takes now, they're likely to keep until spring. You know, yeah, I guess you do know, don't you? It's funny, man, the Democratic Party's way of war. They're just going to leave. They're pulling all their guys out other than 10 to 20,000, 15,000 troops leaving behind. That is pure politics. That is not a military plan. That is a political plan. I would like to see anyone on a congressional committee, some, you know, NBC type on TV, just once say to the generals, tell me how this is going to work out here, man. You got co-presidents who hate each other. You got still, you know, ethnic splits across the entire region, where it's all Hazaras, Uzbeks, and Tajiks in one coalition of groups that hate each other versus the Pashtun, who are basically saddled with the Taliban. It's not that they really love the Taliban any more than you and me love the Democrats or the Republicans. It's just that's who they're stuck with as far as their political representation goes. That's all they've got. And, you know, I said to Ann Jones on the show, geez, about a year ago now, well, man, so what's going to happen when America leaves? Is the Taliban just going to walk right into Kabul? She said, the Taliban are in Kabul, you know. They ain't going to walk right into Kabul. They'd have to just walk around in a circle, I guess. They're already there. They're in the parliament. And they've got front men in the parliament more than, you know, actual Talibs. But they're part of the governing coalition. You know, the war was lost about a year and a half, 2 years ago. Been this way. So, it's amazing to me the Republicans are letting them get away with it. Not that I'm trying to provoke them or anything, but it would seem like... And, you know, I know John McCain is saying we can't leave Afghanistan. It's going to be just like Iraq. And he's right. It's going to be just like Iraq. Well, actually, you know, it wasn't the withdrawal from Iraq. It was the withdrawal from Iraq plus especially support for the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria that blew back into Iraq, as, you know, Patrick Coburn was warning was going to happen for 3 years before it happened. But anyway, it is the same kind of thing in the effect that, you know, what's keeping Mullah Omar from marching back in or strolling back into Kabul and declaring himself, you know, competing caliph to Omar Baghdadi? Just now a few thousand American soldiers and some drones. And, you know, I don't know, it might be a little longer than that. But the Afghan army and the Afghan police, those forces will not exist without America there. In fact, here's the Green Berets. Green Berets say, Afghan troops hide during fights, rely on U.S. Zabul battle saw Afghan forces hiding behind a rock. And talk among Pentagon officials that the Afghan military is increasingly able to operate on its own is just that, talk, as a new report includes comments from Green Berets criticizing the incompetence of the Afghan National Army. The Green Berets complained particularly of an early June battle in the Zabul province, during which Afghan soldiers were refusing to fight and, quote, hiding among the trees and behind a rock while they waited for the U.S. troops to do the fighting. Such reports aren't normally the sort of thing that go public. And ended up in the report on a... Oh, but ended up in the report on a friendly fire airstrike that killed five soldiers during the battle. That's the same battle where Andrew Coburn was on the show talking about the B-2 that did the friendly fire that killed the five. Anyway, so there you go. And everybody already knows that. Watch the Vice documentary. This is what victory looks like. You want to know about the state of the Afghan army and police forces there. Whatever, call it a victory, it's fine. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. And now, you know what? I can't believe that this even needs saying, but it does, so I'll say it. Freedom of speech is important. It sort of doesn't matter what's being said. It's the fact that people got the right to say what they want on their own property or on the commons. Right? They don't have the right to go inside your house and say whatever they want.
You have every right to exclude people for saying what you don't want them to say at your house. Otherwise, on their own private property, they have the right to say whatever the hell they want, or anywhere that they're an invited guest and welcomed by the owners to say what they want. Or, as has been the tradition in America, on the commons, that is, government, quote-unquote, owned property. And that would include, say, for examples, perhaps most importantly, at public universities. And now, I'm watching this thing this morning. I'm watching Fox News. And they're talking about how a bunch of hippies at Berkeley are trying to get Bill Maher banned, disinvited from a speaking engagement at their university. Really? At Berkeley? Isn't that where the, quote, free speech movement, end quote, was born? You're afraid of Bill Maher? And then what's their critique of Bill Maher? That he's a racist. He's a racist. Well, you're a nitwit if you think all Muslims are Arabs. I don't know what to do with you. He could be an anti-religious bigot, if you want to say that. Although I don't even think that's really true. I don't think he ever really said he hates Muslims, because anyone who believes in Islam is obviously a bad person on the face of it. He just criticizes the religion. And so what? And if he criticized everyone who believed in it for being so base as to believe in it, still. And by the way, although this shouldn't matter, I hate Bill Maher's sorry stinking guts, and I always have, from back when Politically Correct was on the Comedy Channel. I couldn't stand that this middle-of-the-road Hillary Clinton Democrat, was going to claim the mantle Politically Incorrect. What are you talking about? You love Hillary Clinton. You're not politically incorrect. You are toeing the line. Politically Incorrect would be Bill Maher going on and on about Judaism. And now he can't stand anybody who believes in that. But you don't hear him talk like that. Why? Because he's Jewish. I mean, he's an atheist. And he'll give you a, well, you know, it's not that good of a thing. Well, the Jews made up the God that the Islamics believe in, Bill. So which is the problem, really? When they're just Hebrew mythology 3.0 over there in Islam land. Idiot. And the guy is, he's the worst kind of Democrat. He's absolutely disgusting, and he's horrible on virtually everything. And then he calls himself a libertarian. And he says things like, well, but I smoke pot, so that makes me a libertarian. Would somebody please behead this guy for me? I mean, I can't do it because I'm a libertarian, but maybe one of you conservatives or liberals who doesn't recognize morality at all, as, you know, any restriction on your behavior. Would somebody, how about this? How about dress him up in blackface and then put him out in front of cops? And then they'll have sovereign immunity. There will be no sin, no crime, because they're cops, and they can kill whoever they want. You just got to make them look like a black guy for a minute. I hate Bill Maher, obviously, more than all of your hatred for Bill Maher combined. The more horrible things happen to Bill Maher, the better. And in fact, I hate him because of what he says about Islam even more than I already did. And I already have my own problems with Islam. I wouldn't mind talking bad about Islam all day. But in the current context, the reason we have a clash of civilizations in the world is because of the American Empire. Not because of anything wrong with the Muslim religion or Arabs or any of that crap. Islamic extremism and all this crap. It's 2014. Who's believing this? The problem is the empire. The terrorists are resistance to the empire. Doesn't make them good. It's just a description of their actual role in the world as opposed to some fake one. some ridiculous one, no matter what they propound or no matter what atheists like Bill Maher propound about them. But the point is, let the man say whatever he wants. The solution to a bad argument is more argument. Or like me daydreaming about horrible things happening to him, you know. I don't know. It's still just an argument. I was just trying to prove my point that I dislike him more than you dislike him. But still, he ought to be able to say whatever he wants. And pardon me for a minute, but this is 2014, and anyone who believes in Judaism, Christianity, or Islam believes in fantasy magic land. You might as well believe in Zeus on Mount Olympus. Why would Hebrew mythology be any more realistic than Greek mythology? Huh? Or Hindu mythology? Right. It's all just stories people told each other back thousands of years ago. None of it's true. There's not one God. There's not no gods. So how is it that the Muslims are any kookier than the Christians or the Jews when they all believe in the invisible man in the sky like the tooth fairy, equally with each other? Oh, the earth that I actually live on? No, never mind any of that. My whole belief system is caught up in what the invisible man in the sky I pretend to believe in wants. It's all the definition of insanity. So is there anything special about Muslims that makes them any crazier than Jews or Christians? Of course not. I mean, in Pakistan, they have a horrible tradition, especially in Pakistan, in other Muslim countries too, where they do not tolerate, as Bill Maher likes to complain, they do not tolerate conversion. Someone wants to convert from Islam to Christianity. Hell, Clive Stafford Smith explained on the show, people do or say something that is misconstrued as being offensive in any way to the religion, and they can be put to death. Smith was just describing that on the show the other day, but that's not exclusive to Islam. That may be a real problem in Pakistan, but it's not a real problem in all Muslim countries, so that proves right there that it's not a problem endemic necessarily to, or, you know, I don't know, endemic. Inherent in Islam. Same thing for treatment of women, same thing for lots of things. And they don't have to be like Sufi, very lightweight, Unitarian type Muslims to be decent and modern and quote-unquote progressive on those issues, politically correct on issues like, you know, women owning property and whatever, whatever. I guess I do agree with Bill Maher that Islam needs a reformation. And Judaism and Christianity, they've already had their reformations. They've already had their reform movements, too. They're kind of, let's chill out a little bit on the each and every word is literal kind of interpretations. But anyway, I'm all over the place on this. But I'm just trying to say, I hate Bill Maher. I think all religion is stupid, but I don't, this is probably the first time you've ever heard me say this stuff, because I don't really care, and you don't hear me attacking people, because I believe in freedom more. I believe in freedom ultimately, and that people have the right to believe in whatever faith they want, if they want, and I respect that, it's fine. I just think it's kind of stupid myself, personally is all. But for God's sake, to have people shouting someone down and not allowing them to speak, especially on something like this, they can't make an argument for religious freedom with their freedom of speech? It's crazy. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5. At MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Jeez, I hope nothing I said hurt anybody's feelings. I guess there should be a law against me saying things that hurt people's feelings. Maybe you should go to the dean. Maybe you should call Ian. And say, that's Scott Horton hurting my feelings. Stop him from talking. I'm telling on you. Anyway, I don't know. If bigotry is so wrong, which it is, I mean, maybe not. Maybe that's just a matter of opinion, but I was raised that way my whole life, and I'm just an individualist, and I got minority members of my family and whatever the hell. I just don't. I'm like Stephen Colbert, even better. I'm just as colorblind as can be, but okay, assuming the premise that all decent people agree that bigotry is wrong, then why should any of us be afraid of some idiot like Bill Maher explaining why he's a bigot and why other people ought to agree with him? He couldn't possibly make a solid case, right? And then any of us could whoop him, right? By saying, well, geez whiz, Bill Maher, there's more than a billion Muslims in the world. And all they do all day long is go to work and come home and play with their kids and make sweet, sweet love to their wives. And their kids and wives are also Muslims. And they're just normal human beings, just like you and me. Virtually all of them. Right? And then the exceptions are who? The wannabe politicians among them. Shrug. Right. So there you go. His entire case is all wet. And especially the fact that this is going on in 2014. That's what bothers me about this. Not the free speech part, but the part about blaming radical Islam and all this crap. Like I was saying last week on the show, I've been watching a lot of Fox News and I mean, they will even talk like, and this has been going on the whole time, really. They'll say things like, we're never going to get to the bottom of this until we examine the motivation of these people. But then they don't examine the motivation at all. They just assert it. Islamic extremism. As though there's some gray scale. And the more you believe in Islam, the more dedicated you get to finally just strapping on a suicide belt and attacking things that are good and pale-skinned. Does that make any sense to anyone? Only people who like being lied to. The problem is the American Empire. The problem is the American Empire has killed more than 1 million people. Going on 2 million since 1990 in the Arab world. Okay? There you go. That's what it is. Bin Laden, back in 1996, said the reason I'm sending my guys to kill you is because of your support for Israel and their mass murders in southern Lebanon and in the occupied territories of Gaza and the West Bank, and because of your permanent bases on the holy land of Mecca, Medina, the Arabian Peninsula, that you use to bomb and blockade and starve and murder Iraqis by the hundreds of thousands. And so I'm coming to kill you. And then he says, because that's what Mohammed would do and whatever. But that's just his recruitment shtick. Look at how many people of how many different faiths joined up the army after September 11th in this country to go and fight them. It wasn't about their religion. You had people from San Diego as far as you could get. People from Hawaii and Alaska as far as you could get from New York who said, hey, that's an attack on me. And I'm fighting back. Yeah, well, that's why Libyans went to go fight in Iraq. That's why Saudis joined up to die on 9/11 to kill some of us. It's about politics. It's about occupation. Of course they dress it up in Islam for the same reason that George W. Bush and General Boykin and Eric Prince from Blackwater dress up their mass murder and religion too. Public relations. You know, I forget who it was I interviewed now that talked about how Bush would have these very obscure Old Testament references in his speeches that the rest of us would think, well, that's kind of a funny turn of phrase or whatever, but we wouldn't necessarily recognize. But these are all very serious dog whistles for the fundamentalists out there, for the premillennialists. To get them all excited. It's just the same thing. And that's not to say that, Osama bin Laden didn't truly believe in his religion. It's not to deny that in the Quran that Muhammad calls for Muslims to defend other Muslims from being attacked. That's in there too. What he doesn't say is conquer the world and cut everybody's head off for not believing the same as us. He doesn't say that. The only times that Muhammad says kill Christians and Jews is in specific sections about actual battles that were going on at the time. When they were living, I think it was on the peninsula where there were Christians and Jews, Christian and Jewish settlements on the peninsula, and they were at war. But at other times, after the fact, he instructed his followers to live at peace with them and to trade with them and etc. like that. So, anyway, and bin Laden never said in any of his recruitment shtick, and never mind what you believe he believed, because, you know, I think the guy's a mass murderer of men, women, and children too, so screw him. I'm not citing him like you should believe in his honesty or anything like that. I'm just saying, here's a guy who got people to do what he wanted them to do. He wasn't the head of a government. He didn't have tax money. He didn't have the law to make people follow. He didn't have conscription. He had basically, you know, flyers up on the wall. Come and join me and attack the far enemy. Why would anybody do that? Because of foreign policy. Because of what the Americans are doing. And here again, Michael Scheuer, for the 10 millionth time, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, a guy who was more determined to kill him. It's not like he was a fan of the guy. He had respect in that other sense of the term, respect for his avowed enemy. He's the guy who tried to get Bill Clinton to kill Osama bin Laden 10 different times before 9/11 even happened. And he said, here's what bin Laden would tell people. He would say, they back the Israelis in their occupations of Lebanon and Palestine. They support all the dictators in the Middle East. They got bases on the Arabian Peninsula that they use to bomb and blockade and starve and murder Iraqis. They put pressure on the dictators to manipulate the price of oil to keep it low so that our people go hungry while the American people have cheap energy for themselves. And they turn a blind eye and or support Russia, China, and India in their wars against Muslims too. So that's the proof that America is evil. That was what he would say. And people would say, well, geez, I can't dispute any of those facts. So why is it that we should attack them? And then he would say, because once we can lure them into our sand trap and completely bankrupt their empire and force them out in humiliation and disgrace like the USSR, then we can accomplish our more parochial goals, like overthrowing the king of Saudi Arabia, for example. Oh, and the Ayatollah in Iran. Bin Laden desperately wanted a regime change there, of course. But anyway, so yes, and bin Laden also said that, chapter this, that, and the other thing from the Holy Book says we should do something about it. But he wasn't saying the Holy Book says that we should do something about the fact that there are rich white Christians living over there in peace in the middle part of North America, leaving us alone all the time. Unacceptable. We have to go and attack them until they convert to Islam or some crap. I believe in my Islam so extremely that I just feel like traveling to North America and killing innocent people for no reason. And look at the people who join up. They're not all extremists in the sense of their belief in Islam. And so, of course, to Bill Maher, this is just a talking point that, right, any Islam at all is enough to make somebody do this terrible stuff. But that's not the point. It's that any Islam at all is enough to make them, some of them, identify with other Muslims as fellow Muslims, as brothers in their same faith. And then they decide to join up the war, putting their highest value, their religious faith, first. And so they join up the war, just like an American, sometimes Americans. They join up the war, but on the other side. You know, the truthers like to say, they're not Islamic extremists. Look, the hijackers went to strip bars. So that proves that they had no motivation to do the attack at all. Well, the motivation never was extreme Islamic belief. It was always a hatred of American support for Israel and the king of Saudi Arabia and the mass murder of Iraqis. You don't have to be a religious kook to be angry about that.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com.
Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up is, first up on the show today is William Norman Grigg. He writes at Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. His book is Liberty in Eclipse. You can get it in paperback or in audiobook. Welcome back. How are you doing, Will?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on again as a guest.
Very happy to have you back. I can never keep track of when your show's on. When's your show on?
Saturday night at 8 o'clock Mountain Time, which is 7 o'clock Pacific or 9 o'clock Central, at libertyroundtable.com is the easiest way to find it. There's an online streaming version of the program, libertyroundtable.com, cool. And that would be every Saturday night at 8 o'clock Mountain.
Okay, great. I'll try to say that again at the end of the thing. And then, but we can find the archives there too?
They don't have an archive, but I do have an archive, and I have a link to it at the bottom of every essay I publish at Pro Libertate.
Right. Okay, there we go. And you know what else you guys can find at the bottom of each essay at Pro Libertate? The tip jar. So, you know what? I think just read one essay by Will Grigg, and you'll think to yourself, boy, I sure would like to help this guy keep writing things. And then it'll be great for everybody. Okay, good.
Very kind. I appreciate that.
Well, you know, yeah, you're a great writer. And you got your priorities straight, too. So you're a great writer squared. All right.
Wonderful.
So
thank you.
First thing I want to talk about, I mean, you got such great articles about such horrible stuff going on. I want to let you talk about all of it. But first of all, we got to talk about the big news in the police state right now, and that is Ferguson. And all the spin, and maybe it's right. I don't know, Will. Is it really right, like they say on Fox News, that, oh, it turns out that, well, he had it coming, and that the cops' version of the story must have been right, and so, therefore, all the witnesses who say that he was surrendering, had his hands up, they must all be lying, and no wonder he'll be the officer, Darren Wilson, who shot and killed Mike Brown in St. Louis, will be no-billed here any day now.
I'm thoroughly expecting that he's going to be no-billed because it's almost impossible to indict and prosecute a police officer for homicide in the state of Missouri owing to the fact that their state statutes recognize them as privileged aggressors. There's actually a specific provision in the Missouri state code which recognizes the supposed right of a police officer to initiate aggressive violence and kill somebody when it's clearly not an act of defense, whether you're talking about self-defense or defense of other innocent people.
Really?
Furthermore, Robert McCulloch, who's the...
Wait. Stop on the furthermore there and go back to the really a second.
Yes.
It says in there that they have the right to initiate deadly force?
What it says is that there is an exception here with respect to the homicide statute's treatment of defensive force that applies specifically to police officers.
Wow.
Every other case involving defensive force, you pretty much have a duty to establish that you as the agent of lethal force were acting defensively. That's not true of a police officer. There is a specific exception in the Missouri state statutes. I've not been able to find a similar one. I'm pretty confident that similar ones exist, but I've not been able to find one that is so blatant and brazen as the one in the state of Missouri.
Wow.
And that creates an almost impossibly high threshold if you're a diligent prosecutor, McCulloch obviously is not, who's seeking to prosecute a police officer for manifestly unlawful killing. You've got a very high hurdle to cross, and Mr. McCulloch is not particularly motivated to cross that hurdle. He is notoriously deferential to police. He always has been. The memory of man runneth not to a time when he's actually prosecuted successfully a police officer who has shot somebody who is unarmed or otherwise harmless, or somebody who didn't deserve to be the malign focus of the attention of a police officer to begin with. And his office is obviously, has to be, the source of these leaks. These leaks are not coming from the camp of Michael Brown, obviously. But the thing that I find really interesting here is that the story was framed in advance of the disclosure of the document, if you will, because the document, the autopsy report, could be read as validating Wilson's current current story, and of course we don't have his original story. That's an important part of this case. He never filed an instant report, which means we cannot review his initial story against whatever emerges as a result of the evidence being presented to the grand jury. But it can also be read in a way that is very favorable to the account provided by Dorian Johnson and the other witnesses, who said that there was a struggle of some sort inside the police vehicle, and that during that struggle, Officer Wilson discharged his weapon, causing Michael Brown to flee, because the injury on the hand, the reported injury on the hand of Michael Brown, would be consistent with somebody trying to swat away an already drawn gun in order to defend himself against being killed. And what Dorian Johnson said, it just in the immediate aftermath of the killing, was that Wilson pulled his gun and threatened to kill Brown. And Brown tried to defend himself, that a shot was fired and Brown fled, and that he was shot several times at a significant distance while he was fleeing or while he was surrendering. There's nothing in the reported autopsy report, the text of the autopsy report, or the way that it's been treated in the press that is inconsistent with that account. What I do find interesting is that the Post-Dispatch in St. Louis County and then the Washington Post both quoted at some length Dr. Judy Melnick, who apparently spoke with somebody from the Post-Dispatch, but nobody from the Post, and they substantially misrepresented her comments as she read this report. She didn't have any direct involvement in the autopsy or in the investigation. And she went on, I believe it was MSNBC, and did a very lengthy interview in which she described at some length the ambiguities in the report, and she explicitly said that she had not been accurately quoted in the initial news report.
Okay, and now this is the lady who the quote is, well, if there's blood on the gun, that means he was going for it, and this kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and that's not what she said.
So, so just to be clear, in case people aren't caught up on this, or whatever, these were the quotes that the pro-cop right and Fox News and everybody took and ran with a million miles an hour. Oh, see,
exactly.
What a simple statement of fact. There was a dot of blood on the gun, that means he went for it.
If there's blood on the gun, it could mean that he went for it in the sense of trying to disarm and kill the police officer. It could also mean that he was trying to defend himself against an unjust summary execution by the police officer. But the trajectory of the bullet wound suggests that he was trying to move the gun away rather than he was trying to seize the gun to begin with.
Right.
And the gun in that case would have been already drawn without just cause. Remember...
But wait. Hang on one second. Remind me in a minute. I hope you don't forget. But if I understand this right, and if I understand what you've just explained, I want to kind of sum up and make sure that I'm on the same page with you here. They came out, this report was leaked, the right-wing and pro-cop media said, oh, see, this proves that he went for the gun, that there was a struggle in the car, this, that, and the other thing. But on the other side of that, as I think you're explaining here, the story of the witnesses, of all the other witnesses, the ones that we would think would be called by a prosecutor going after this cop if there was such a thing. They all agreed that, yeah, there was a struggle in the car.
Yeah.
The friend of Mike Brown agreed, yeah, there was a struggle in the car. He tried to grab him, bumped him with the door, then he tried to grab him, I guess, through the open window in a clumsy kind of way. He pulled his gun, the gun went off, he shot the guy in the hand, or whatever. Like, this was already not in dispute. And what they're saying is, oh, my God, look, Mike Brown was within the vicinity of the patrol car, everybody. But, yeah, so what? We already all knew that. What am I leaving out? What nuance am I skipping here?
I don't think you're skipping any of the relevant nuances here, because these people are seizing upon the well-established with a sense of original discovery, as if this were a critical disclosure when, as you pointed out, and as I pointed out, Dorian Johnson has never disputed that there was a struggle within the car. And this is something that other witnesses have confirmed as well. There was obviously a struggle of some sort in the car. There was a gunshot fired during the course of that struggle. What is in dispute here is whether you had, on the one hand, Brown trying to seize the weapon from the police officer or trying to shove the weapon away rather than simply being killed while he's involved in this altercation through the open door or the open window of this vehicle. But he did flee, and after he had fled, there was no reason for additional shots to be fired at that point. Under standard protocol, as I understand it, what the officer should do is call for backup and then go in pursuit of this suspect, if indeed the suspect should be arrested, detained, and prosecuted. And so the question here is twofold. First of all, did Brown act defensively? And secondly, once he had fled, did Wilson Johnson have any just cause to shoot him?
Right.
But that's something that the autopsy report doesn't address, but you'd never know that on the basis of the coverage that we're hearing from the punitive populace who instinctively take the side of the police officer.
Back in 1 second with Will Grigg. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So I'm talking with Will Grigg. He's at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. No, really, he insists. freedominourtime.blogspot.com for his great blog, Pro Libertate. The book, again, is called Liberty in Eclipse. Get it in paperback or audiobook. All right, so now we're talking Ferguson. And so, in other words, all the whole spin that, oh, he had it coming and the poor cop is being falsely maligned and whatever, like we're hearing from all the right-wing radio guys and Fox News, etc. This is all a bunch of hogwash. And all they've discovered is the same thing that everybody already knew, was that there was a confrontation between Mike Brown and Officer Darren Wilson at the point of the vehicle before he fled and was shot from behind and turned around and was shot in the front. Also based on alleged misquotes. You're telling me that the expert quoted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch piece and then copied and pasted all around the planet like Mark Twain's infamous lie running around the world, even though it's a lie that that's his quote. It's somebody else, but he always gets the credit. I forgot who it was. Anyway, she says, I never said that. She went on MSNBC and said, I never said that. Will, please elaborate, would you?
Yes, she went on Lawrence O'Donnell's program, Dr. Judy Melnick, and said that what she had said was limited to the findings within the autopsy, and that it could be consistent with one story or the other, but that they extrapolated from her comments some kind of an overarching ratification of the story that is being told on behalf of Darren Wilson. And once again, we don't have Darren Wilson's original story. He didn't fill out an incident report. And that's one of the things you find in a lot of jurisdictions, is the police are able to revise and extend their stories as the evidence comes in so that they can craft the most self-serving narrative possible. And this is particularly true in St. Louis County, where Robert McCulloch, as I pointed out, the DA there, is expansively tolerant of the unlawful use of force, including lethal force by police officers. But yes, she went on MSNBC and had a very lengthy and not entirely congenial interview with Mr. O'Donnell. She did not want to be forced in either direction in terms of the narrative here. She didn't want to attenuate her commitment to the observable facts as documented in this autopsy that was conducted by another professional. But one of the things she pointed out is that we don't have a lot of the other evidence that would tell a fuller story, such as the expended rounds that did not hit Mr. Brown. There were other rounds that were fired in his direction that would tell us a great deal about where the two of them were located and help us construct or reconstruct the actual incidents far more accurately than the mere autopsy report would do. But what has happened here, as you point out, Scott, is that a couple of sound bites were extracted from her interview with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, according to Dr. Melnick, irresponsibly embellished upon her remarks. And that embellishment was seized upon by the Washington Post, which, contrary to popular opinion, is not a liberal journal. It's a statist one. It's an establishmentarian newspaper. And they took the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and that was the seed germ of a larger story that had another set of irresponsible assumptions written into it. And from the Post, of course, used as a template, were struck all these other pieces that have been circulated throughout not only establishment media but social media and the blogosphere. And it's all being used to ratify the idea that any time a police officer shoots somebody, particularly of Michael Brown's age and ethnicity, then we should assume that the police officer acted correctly. And that is, as I pointed out before, an intensely and innately anti-American assumption. The whole premise of Americanism rests on the assumption that people who are public officials, who are government agents, have to justify what they do to the citizens. You don't assume that they are right whenever they take any kind of action, particularly when they take a life. Explain yourself, damn it, should be the Americans' reflexive response whenever he sees a police officer using violence against a citizen. But there are certain precincts of the right, I call them the punitive populists, who simply assume that the one great exception to their otherwise overarching rejection of government power should be the local police. And the local police are, of course, to use an expression I've employed before, they are as to the state as the edge is to the blade. They are the people who actually inflict violence. It becomes tangible rather than abstract when you're talking about the local law enforcement as the manifestation of this thing we call the state. But I think this is tied up, unfortunately, in a lot of racial presuppositions. Ferguson is a majority black community. There's a terrific essay, and actually it's a very detailed research piece I wanted to plug here, that was published by the Economic Policy Institute by attorney Richard Rothstein, entitled The Making of Ferguson, Public Policies at the Root of Its Troubles. And it talks about segregation, and everybody talks about white flight, of course, as the phenomenon that left behind a number of communities there in St. Louis County, including Ferguson. But what he points, and I'm quoting now from this essay, government policies turned black neighborhoods into overcrowded slums, and white families came to associate African Americans with slum characteristics. White homeowners then fled when African Americans moved nearby, fearing their new neighbors would bring slum conditions with them. That government, not mere private prejudice, was responsible for segregating greater St. Louis was once conventional informed opinion. And then in the course of 64 pages, he documents the fact that you have market interruption by the government beginning 100 years ago under Woodrow Wilson, who was a horrible bigot, among other things. You have market interruption that prevented the integration of St. Louis and a number of other cities across the United States, of course. And this was amplified by our good friend Harold Ickes under the New Deal, and nothing happened during the Civil Rights Revolution in the 1960s to alter this in any significant way. But these communities that are being plundered through confiscatory police action, Ferguson's typical of them, we talked about this before, where people are being stopped on trivial or invented violations and put into a system where they end up with these onerous enactments, these onerous fines and fees that are imposed upon them and leave them in a position where they're not able to go out and get productive work. These communities were created by government action to the point where they were actually rezoning a lot of greater St. Louis in order to sluice vice into these black inhabited areas, things like gambling and prostitution. They didn't just spring up sua sponte in these black communities. They were channeled there as a matter of deliberate municipal policy, and the same thing's happening now with respect to tax collection at the point of a gun and the gun's in the hand of the police officer, which is one of the reasons I suspect why you had this encounter between Wilson and Brown. Brown was not being sought as a suspect in a robbery at the time. He was being harassed because he was walking in an unoccupied street, and that's the sort of trivial violation upon which the police and prosecutors in that part of St. Louis County feed. And as a result, you have this completely avoidable conflict that escalated into a death, and now the machinery is in motion to exonerate Wilson in spite of the fact that we have no reason to think that what he did was in any way justifiable, and really the burden should be on him to demonstrate that it was justifiable, not the other way around.
Yeah. Hey, can I keep you one more segment? Because the music's about to start playing, and I'm not done talking to you at all yet.
Oh, let's do that.
Okay, cool. Because, one of the things I wanted to ask about is just how simple this is as a left and right issue, or is it a white and black issue? I think it's more of just a left and right thing, where if you're a conservative, you're just supposed to love this. But I don't really see the logic in that other than just kind of simple redneck racism, really. But, identifying with the cop more than the victim in that kind of more simple way. But I'm sure that you'll have something smarter to say about that. And then
I hope so.
and then I got a lot of other stuff I want to ask you, too. So everybody hang out. It's Will Grigg from freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Hit that PayPal button while you're there, would you? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. I'm looking at Twitter trying to figure out, how do you get someone who writes for Salon.com to care about the Waco massacre? How about some of those women in there never had a chance to have an abortion. They might have wanted one. No, I guess probably not. They're not going to believe that. Well, maybe if we pointed out that about a third of the people in there were black. They're a protected species of the left in America, right? Or not if they're hanging around with a mullet-headed, Trans Am-driving right-winger like David Koresh, huh? At that point, they cede their blackness and their right to have their rights protected. At that point, they're just rednecks. That's the real problem, isn't it, Will Grigg? That this is all just partisanship. Right-wingers love to see liberals and left types killed, and vice versa. Waco as the perfect example of that.
Yeah, tragically, that does appear to be the case. People are more fixated on trying to discomfort and to suppress those whom they hate rather than trying to preserve that which they love. I've talked about this before as well. The most successful political theorist in the modern world, beginning around 1900, would be Vladimir Lenin. He digested all the politics down to one simple formula. The key question is, who does what to whom? In other words, you want to be the who rather than the whom, and the what becomes inconsequential. And unfortunately, if you're somebody who's been assigned to one of these political ghettos by our self-anointed rulers, you think of yourself in terms of your tribal affiliations. It may be ethnicity, it may be social status, it may be a shared enthusiasm for certain types of popular culture. You might like Toby Keith, for instance. I don't know why you would. But you think of yourself in terms of this cohort of people, and you want to make sure that those who are our rulers, the people who are in positions of elected power, in other words, represent your faction, and the your power doesn't end up in the hands of the wrong people who would be the left-wingers, the sort of people who like, I don't know, from indie rock or hip-hop or something. They like different kinds of popular entertainment, and of course they vote for a different group of statists, and they're all, of course, the statists in question drawn from the same stable of fungible corporatist hacks and shills. But the difference is we get to define ourselves by the hostility we feel toward the other faction, and we have this cultivated instinct to look upon each other with absolutely irrepressible hostility and ignore what's being done to all of us by the cohort that presumes to rule us. And so you define your perception of what the ruling class does in terms of whether it injures your people or their people. And when you're talking about the reflexive, up until recently anyway, support that you saw on behalf of your stereotypical conservatives for the local police, this is always something that's done on an as-applied basis. Many of the same people who would assume that Darren Wilson acted properly because of the identity of the person he shot are the sort of people who would have fuzzbusters or other paraphernalia in their cars so that they can avoid detection and the attention of the police. Why is that, do you think? It's because they understand that they might very well end up on the business end of some implement of mayhem being wielded by part of this consecrated elite of dispensers of violence, and they don't much relish that prospect. So when it comes to them and theirs, they don't want to be the recipient of the same type of attention that Michael Brown received. But they don't have the moral imagination to understand that the same should be true of Michael Brown and his friends and family, and that just as they wouldn't really like to find themselves being harassed and then unjustly injured or killed by police, that perhaps the same is true of Michael Brown. But they look upon Michael Brown and they look upon the people who surround him now as supporters as being inescapably and incurably other. And that reflects, I think, a triumph of mass indoctrination by our self-appointed ruling class. And it's a tragedy. And it's one I have some fleeting and some embattled optimism that we're going to overcome, because, Scott, I do think we've reached what I've called the point of peak jackboot, which is to say peak public tolerance for this type of arrogant, unaccountable violence on the part of the police. And it's not something that's uniform, but I think that a large enough cohort within the population has finally had a surfeit of this. The people are starting, however tentatively, to condemn and resist and fight back. I don't know if you saw the video that was publicized yesterday by the good folks at the Free Thought Project of this Alejandra Natividad, who was a cop in La Quinta, California.
Please, I was going to ask you about that. Please talk about that.
This is the most inspiring thing I've seen in many years. He was with a friend, and they pulled up at a stoplight, and his friend was driving the car and started to behave strangely, and that came to the attention of a deputy who was stationed at the street corner. And he had the two pull over, and the two got out of the car.
By the description, it sounded like maybe the guy had a mild seizure or something.
Something like that, grand mal seizure, some kind of a mental episode or a neurological episode. So this is a case where a police officer, if he were a peace officer, would be inclined to help. But no, the first order of business is prone yourself out before me. You know, assume this self-abnegating posture of complete submission before me. And God bless Alejandro Natividad, he said, no, I'm not. I'm standing at a distance. I'm neither advancing, I'm not retreating, but I'm not getting on the ground. I've not committed a crime. You have no right to order me to get on the ground. I'm not going to do it. And by this time, of course, the deputy had his gun drawn. And about 5 or 6 minutes of one of the most amazing dramas I've ever witnessed unfurled, as Natividad, talking about the fact that he was a veteran, had served in the Army, appealed to the man behind the badge. There's just a man on the other hand, on the other side of this badge and this gun. Deal with me as a man. You know, stop pretending as if you got the right to order me to prone myself out in front of you. And by the end of this, at least two other deputies had shown up. And as I understand it, Natividad was eventually shackled and put in the back of a police car, but released without charges. But this reminded me, in the broadest sense, of the heroism of Wang Wei Lin. He's Tank Man from Tiananmen Square back in June of 1989. Granted, you didn't have this man standing off an entire armored column, but given what we know about police militarization, that's a very vivid possibility, because all it takes is one gesture of unreconstructed defiance, and as the Waco example illustrates, there is literally no limit to what they're willing to do in order to make sure that that defiance is put down hard. Yeah. But this
well,
man,
he was looking straight down the barrel of three guns, so... It didn't need to be a tank at all. He was as brave as that, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, he was facing the imminent prospect of physical extinction. And what he had said is, if I'm going to get it, I might as well get it standing on my feet rather than prostrating myself at the feet of the people who'd kill me. That's a tremendously inspiring thing, and I hope that this is something that will become contagious.
Yeah, people can find that, as you said, at the Free Thought Project. It's also at libertycrier.com. And, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, the bravery there is really something else. And, you know, for the cop, too, the cop doesn't just say, all right, what the hell, and holster his gun, or even, like, put it at his side. He still is just, you know, what is going through the head of these people, man? What are they telling them at training about the average goofball at the stoplight? I don't get it. I mean, how could it be, whatever crazy thing it must be that they're telling them, that they believe it to be true?
Well, they're indoctrinated to look upon the public at large as a mass of undifferentiated menace, and that the most important imperative that they confront is officer safety, and that success is defined by making people submit and making sure that they go home safely at night. And when I've talked about this with our local sheriff here in Payette County, Chad Huff, one of the things he shared with me, and I think I've shared with you before, is that he's at wit's end dealing with people who come out of the post academy here in Meridian, Idaho. He says, I get these people who come out of post. They've been indoctrinated to look upon the public as the enemy, and Chad Huff is in his late 40s. He's of a different generational cohort. He says, I understand that I'm supposed to be serving these people, so I have to de-thugify my deputies. He literally has to deprogram them as if he's retrieving them from the fell clutches of a cult, which I think is actually a pretty good description, and trying to reintroduce them to the idea that the people they're supposed to serve are actual human beings, that their rights are just as important as those of the individual police officers, and that if they're going to be serving in his department and wearing the uniform of his department, that they're going to have to assume certain risks, because officer safety is not the most important consideration. And to the credit of Sheriff Huff here, I know of at least one instance where there was a SWAT standoff involving a domestic violence call, and he took off his gun and went up and knocked on the door and talked to the guy. And in doing so, he managed to incur the wrath of the field commander there, saying, what are you doing? Don't you know you're violating about half a dozen different officer safety protocols? He said, yeah, I'm aware of that, but this is more important. So there are a few of them out there who have the residual humanity and presence of mind to deal with a situation of this sort in a way that involves de-escalation. But this was not de-escalation, as you point out, Scott. This guy had the gun trained on this unarmed man. He's armed only with a cell phone, recording what happened. And the other two who showed up knew nothing about the situation apart from the fact that they'd received a call for help from a member of their fellow tribe of privileged dispensers of violence. They came out with their guns drawn as well. And very few times in the last 25 years, once again, I go back to Tank Man as the precedent here, have you seen such a stark confrontation between a man armed only with unyielding courage and strength of will on the one hand, and then other people who had the means to kill him immediately in the name of this abstraction called the state. And I think that in any other country on the face of the earth, you wouldn't have had this kind of a standoff. And in most circumstances of this kind here in the United States, you'd end up with a guy being beaten or killed by the police. I don't think that's true of any other country on the face of the earth right now. I don't think that there is any other country afflicted with police who enjoy such expansive impunity. I don't know if you saw the video that was recently released of this execution, no other word is suitable, in Michigan last year, where a mentally disturbed man who'd suffered a breakdown, he was apparently armed with a knife, was surrounded by eight cops who shot him 30 times in full public view. There was no threat to the officers at the time that this happened. They formed a picket line, and they executed him.
God dang, now, I didn't see that. Where can people see that?
Oh, for heaven's sake, go to my Facebook page, Scott, and then get a link to it to put with this interview. I think that'll probably be the best way to handle it. Huffington Post, I think, has a link to it this morning.
Jesus,
but
man.
You can contrast that with the recent case that I'm going to be writing about in China. Remember communist China, where you had a man who was armed with something akin to a cleaver who had been involved in a domestic dispute with a woman. You had two police officers show up. One of them distracted him while the other snuck up behind him and disarmed him without pulling a weapon. That's in China, for heaven's sake. They don't execute people on the streets in China, but they do in Michigan. That should tell us something about the extent of our apostasy from the values of Americanism that are expressed in our founding documents are just common sense as human beings.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, too, it's not like you're just some guy. You're Will Grigg. When you say that you don't know of another country in the world where the cops have this much impunity and as a matter of custom, react this severely like that, that's not because of your, you know, vacuum and giant ignorance of the world. You're a guy who can, you know, probably name all 190-something countries in the world if I gave you a few minutes to think about it.
Take a few minutes.
You know, who knows a lot about a lot of things. And I think you're probably right. I don't think in Saudi Arabia or in Zimbabwe or what are the corrupt, meanest other dictatorships in Burma? I guess it depends, again, on who's killing who. But, you know, I think really for the most part, you must be right. I can't think of where you're wrong about that. Iraq?
Yeah, if you read the State Department country reports on human rights, what's really interesting is how frequently they condemn these other countries for doing things that are admittedly horrible, but that are very much part of the established public policy here in the U.S., including museum peace communist regimes like Cuba and North Korea. And just a few months ago, I posted a piece showing a woman in North Korea who actually slapped a police officer who was harassing her for conducting some kind of unauthorized commerce on a public street, and she walked away unscathed. And about 6 or 8 months later, you have Eric Garner being choked to death for doing the same thing on the streets of New York City.
Yeah.
And in Eric Garner's case, he didn't do anything but refuse to comply. In the case of what happened in North Korea, a woman assaulting a police officer. And as I said, here in the United States, she'd be dead. I don't have any doubt at all that she would have been tasered and bludgeoned and perhaps shot. And that's a matter of American exceptionalism as cultural myopia. We assume that we are some happy exception to the general run of mankind when it comes to the abuse of power by people who are given complete impunity. And impunity is something that police enjoy in this country in no small measure due to the influence of police unions, and in large measure because for 40 years or so, people like some of my former colleagues have been indoctrinating the public that if they're local, then the police must be trustworthy, missing the point that nobody who claims power to initiate force can be considered trustworthy. If we're going to have something called a political government, and government, of course, is the praxis of force, it's compulsion, then you have to assume that there are going to be some kind of countervailing mechanisms of accountability, but local police don't have any public accountability. They're accountable to their supervisors and to the municipal corporation that employs them, but they're not subject to electoral accountability. And unfortunately, too many county sheriffs who are electorally accountable now are essentially handmaidens of the federal government through federal subsidies. And it's not just what we see through the 1033 program at the Pentagon that's making them addicted to military toys and other favors, blandishments of that sort. They've been given a license to go out and plunder through asset forfeiture in the name of the war on drugs. And that brings us to another set of cultural presuppositions about how we have to assumed that the only kind of people who would be objecting to what the police do are the druggies, the residual leftover vestigial Woodstock generation, or people like Michael Brown, who reportedly had marijuana in his system. And that's another thing that got put into the mix, as you might appreciate, Scott, was the idea that he had so much THC in his system that he may have been hallucinating at the time he was killed, when it turns out that the toxicology shows that he might have had a couple of cannabis blunts the day before he was killed. You know, this stuff remains in the system for a very long time. And that played into the Bill O'Reilly demographic's perception of reality so perfectly. Oh, look, it's a large black teenage super predator who's blitzed on drugs, including the marijuana, which everybody knows turns people into psychotic fiends. And he beat this poor police officer so severely that it caused an orbital blowout fracture. That's something that is still out there. People still believe that, although it was discredited months ago. So obviously Wilson was justified in doing what he did. Next problem, next question. This has been done with. You know, if it weren't for the malign influence of the Jesse Jacksons and Al Sharptons in the world, nobody would have a problem with it. Besides that, these people would rather be out protesting than working. Ah, there's another cultural presupposition, which is why I brought up that report by Mr. Rothstein. There's a reason why that economy is so depressed. I mean, this is an engineered Bantustan. If you take a look at the way that St. Louis County is designed, you have this ring around the internal core. It's like a donut, and the whole of the donut is black, according to one of the common descriptions you could read in the literature. You know, these people were not allowed the opportunity of living in an actual market economy. For decades, they've been living in an engineered slum as a matter of government policy. So there's something that principled people on the right and left can agree on. Yes, the left is right. There is segregation. There is institutional racism. But you know what? They're incorrect in blaming this on private attitudes. This is where the right has their piece of this proposition. This is something that was engineered through federal policy. This is the result of distortions put into the market as a matter of deliberate policy going back to Harold Ickes and Woodrow Wilson. So why don't you find some common ground here in opposing government-imposed segregation and then the means of coercion that enforce government-imposed segregation and plunder the victims of it, which is what's going on in St. Louis County. But having that conversation would mean that people would have to be motivated by a love of freedom rather than a hatred of the other faction.
Right. Well, and just wait till Jeb comes, and the right has no reason whatsoever to hate or fear the government, and they just
trailing clouds of glory.
I mean, remember the four and a half, five years until Katrina drowned New Orleans. That right wing, you know, it really was a brown shirt mentality. How dare you question the decisions of our leader? They would cry. I mean, it was damn near lynch mob mentality back then, and it's coming again soon.
Yeah, it's been sublimated somewhat, given the fact that somebody representing the other faction now is the dear leader, and so you don't have the active, vibrant, and very aggressive Fuhrer Prinzip that we saw, say, in 2002, 2003, and then again 2006, 2007. One of the things that happens, of course, is that depending upon who's in power, at one point you'll have Sean Hannity saying you hate America if you breathe out so much as tepid endorsement of whatever the dear leader is doing. And then when the wheel turns, you have people like Mr. Schultz, Ed Schultz, from late of MSNBC, saying exactly the same thing. I mean, back in 2011, when Obama waged his unconstitutional war on Libya, Ed Schultz literally said, well, the president said that Gaddafi's responsible for killing Americans. As an American, that's all I need to hear. It was a direct transliteration of Hannity's rhetoric, and I find myself wondering if the chief purpose served by Ed Schultz is to make sure that there is somebody in the media who is at least as stupid as Sean Hannity on the other side. some kind of equity agreement between the factions here. You get a Hannity and we get saddled with the Schultz. You know, that's our handicap. I don't know. But as you say, one of the things that's likely to happen here is if we end up with another Bush, God help us, in the White House, then we're going to see a revival of that mentality. If we end up with Hillary in the White House, we'll see a continuation and exacerbation of what we have right now. And we're once again going to be finding ourselves being played off against each other as if we are the primary problem we confront, not the people who claim to have power over us.
Well, and you know, you say people are, you know, we're at peak, what do you call
it? Jackboot.
Peak jackboot, yeah. Now, so, but then the thing is we've gone so far with people tolerating it that there's a real question of whether any of this can be turned around now. You know, when I was interviewing Shane Bauer about all the militarization of the police, I just started thinking, like, how big you could build a Rocky Mountain chain out of all the armored personnel carriers that have been given to these cops, all the machine guns that have been given to these cops. Whoever is going to repeal it? What state legislature is ever going to say, no, you all have to go back to blue blouses, all of you, now? It's just not going to happen.
Well, it can't happen in the present configuration. I'm one of those people that believe that the only way that we can avoid the United States becoming a political singularity is if we break up the mass right now, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we'd have a geographic reconfiguration of the Union or the emergence of several contending polities within the landmass that is the United States right now. But it means that you do have to have countervailing forces in terms of interposition and nullification. And both the left and the right believe in this. The left has created sanctuary cities. That's a form of interposition. There are other elements of the left that have supported selective decriminalization of marijuana. That's a form of nullification and interposition. And you have the right promoting the same thing with respect to property rights in states like Nevada and other places like that here in the Mountain West. You have to do something about breaking up the mass, or this project is doomed to become the proverbial political singularity. In the case of the Soviet Union, which is, I think, becoming more and more instructive of our predicament, they had a military-industrial complex that was comparable to ours, although nowhere near as well-funded, and they ended up with, of course, a huge overhang of all the surplus from the Red Army and from the internal security units that existed before 1991 or so. And it's taking them the better part of a generation to dig their way out from beneath the rubble. And quite frankly, if we have an American spring here in a genuine sense, and we emerge from beneath what we're facing right now, it's going to take us a generation or so. But what I think is that just as it was said back in the mid-1970s that you probably couldn't find five believing Marxists in Moscow, I find it difficult to believe that within the next few years you're going to be able to find a very large percentage of reflexive cop worshippers here in the United States. I think that's one good thing that social media has done for us, is that it has somewhat demystified and desacralized law enforcement.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that was what Robert Higgs said, was you have this massive confluence here leading to this peak jackboot situation where everyone has a video camera. Everybody's mom has a video camera in their pocket at all times. And the cops are as unleashed or more than ever before. And everybody's got a Facebook feed. And so every local police abuse story is, you know, turned into a YouTube and sent out to the nation. And there's not a damn thing that whoever replaced Dan Rather can do about it or whatever. That all those old channels have lost their monopoly. This thing is just getting around. You can't deny it. I talk to my friends who are not political people at all, and they go, man, on my Facebook, it's just endless police brutality all day. It's out of control. What is going on? And these are people who are not political people, but they just can't escape it. It's crazy. It's everywhere.
Yeah, it's something that transcends politics, because this has to do with something that has no connection necessarily to any of the partisan bickering that passes for politics in this country. It's just a question of people dealing with the unadorned, unfiltered essence of what the state is, which is the power to turn people into things. And I think at that level, there's an understanding growing right now that's very encouraging. That's not to say that we're at any point near the end of this. It just means that there is, I think, grounds for reasonable optimism.
All right. Will Grigg is at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Check out his radio show. Check out his PayPal. Check out his book, Liberty and Eclipse. Thanks, Will.
Thank you so much. Take care, Scott.
Appreciate it. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, guys. So that was Will Grigg on the police state there for you. You know what? Here's that audio, man. I want you guys to hear this. Some of it, anyway. From the Free Thought Project. Also at the Liberty Crier. La Quinta, California.
Get on the ground. Get on the floor. Lay down on the floor. Lay down on the floor.
I'm scared.
Please, I'm scared. Don't
get on the ground.
Don't hurt me. Please. Don't hurt me.
Get on the ground.
I am on the
ground. You too. Get on the ground.
I didn't do anything.
Get on the ground.
I didn't do anything.
I know. Get on the ground until I figure it out.
I'm right here. I'm away. I'm right here. Officer, I'm on. Why you got to point a gun at me?
Get all the way down.
Why you got to point a gun at me? We have no weapons. We have no weapons. We have no weapons. We're not a threat to you. Why do you have the gun pointed at me? I am not a threat. I got out of the car. I surrendered to you. Right here, and you're pointing a gun at me. You're pointing a gun at me. No. You're pointing a gun at me.
I am. Get on the ground.
Are you going to shoot me? I'm not going to run away. I am not a threat to you. I am not a threat to you. I am not a threat to you. Am I walking towards you? No. I am standing right here, scared as hell. I am scared right now. I am afraid of my life. I am not going to get on my ground. I know my rights. You got a gun pointed at me. I have not committed a crime. And no, I will not. I will stay here, and I will not interfere with whatever you got to do. No. I refuse to. This is not a police state, man. It's America, dude. I hate to get all like that, man. But I'm not causing a problem. I realize what just happened right now. Yeah, it was a violation of the law. But it doesn't require for you to pull out a gun. It's not a threat. At least you can use your sense. Come on. It's one man talking to another man. Eliminate the gun or the badge. You're a man. You're a man. You're a man behind that badge. Be like a man. That's a coward pointing a gun at me. I am standing right here, defenseless. I am not doing anything, Deputy. I am not going to do anything. There's no reason why I have two guns pointed at me. There is none. I am not doing anything. I am a law-abiding citizen. I served in the United States Army. Okay, I am scared for my freaking life right now. I got two guns pointed at me. I got two guns pointed at me for nothing. I am standing right here. This is a violation of my rights. Okay? A violation of my rights. And Lord rebuke you. Lord rebuke you for all the, for giving you that power and you abusing it. The Lord rebuke both of you. I have done nothing wrong. And I understand you're backing your buddy up. Because I would too. But there is no reason why a gun should be pointed at me. I am not a threat to you. I am shaking. You're about to cry to you. I'm just crying to you right now. That's all I'm doing. I am not doing anything. I am crying. And you got two guns pointed at me. I am freaking scared. I have another car. There's no reason. There's no reason. No reason for this. No, I am not going to walk this way. Hey, put the guns down. And I'll cooperate. I have not committed a crime. I have yet to commit a crime. I haven't committed a crime. I know I have no weapon. There is no reason to pull anything on me. None. I am not a threat.
So there, they walk up to him with their guns drawn still. And at that point, the video ends. But he reports that they cuffed him. Took him to jail. In fact, he wrote, "We were on our way to my friend's house. And we were at a stoplight. When the light turned green," well, his friend started acting weird. Sounds like he had some kind of weird seizure or something. The light turned green. He didn't go. He's spaced out. The deputy walked up and asked what was going on. And then his friend kind of snapped out of it and drove and took a right. But then stopped, just pulled over. He stepped on the gas and onto the corner, he says. I guess that means like kind of up onto the sidewalk and stopped. He jumped out of his car with his hands up, deputy comes out with his gun drawn, and then that was it. Whatever was wrong with his friend who was driving was the one who was acting weird. He lays down on the ground. Don't kill me, man. Which is perfectly reasonable. But this guy, his name is Alejandro Natividad. He said, no, I know my rights. I'm not going to lie down. And you could see, you know, I think he started crying or getting close to it there when he started realizing that, man, I really might die right now. And still he did not lay down on the ground. That's an American hero right there. I hope that one goes as viral as any video has ever gone. And then he's trying to talk past the badge to the man. Why are you pointing a gun at me? Why are you pointing a gun at me, dude? What the hell is the matter with you? And what's going through the mind of that cop? Does the cop have a mind? He could just holster his gun and say, all right, well, hell, I guess. Lift up your shirt and turn around. Okay, you're not armed. All right, fine. Just keep your hands up while I put your buddy in the back of the car for a minute. Something, right? He could have de-escalated, but no. More cops pull up, and he's so lucky. He's so lucky that the other cop didn't just pull up and blast him. You know, that's what happens right here. Listen to the... We got the video right here of the cop murdering this kid. The kid had his earphones in. He was reaching for his iPod or his phone to turn off the music. And the cop just killed him. This entire event, this entire thing is here, 48 seconds. The cop drives up, pulls his gun out, and just blows this kid away in front of the 7-Eleven. The boy's name is Dylan Taylor. He was a boy. He was 17 years old or something. His name's Dylan Taylor. You can find this at Countercurrent News. Is there audio? I guess there's not audio with this one. Let's see if we hear the gunshots or if it's just a video here. He just walks up. The kid is walking away.
Get your hands out now!
There it is.
Get your hands out! Get them out! Shots fired.
I just murdered some kid. And there you can see the headphone wire right there as the kid's bleeding out. Right there you can see him. Maybe he's already dead. As he's laying on the ground, there's his iPod headphones. So the cop's yelling at him. He didn't hear the cop. He turns around. He sees a cop and goes for his iPod to turn it off. Oh no, apparently a cop is trying to talk to me. Bam, 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 you're dead. And, what do you think? The cop that murdered him is going to go to prison? Think he'll get anything worse than 2 weeks paid vacation? So, this guy, Alejandro, had every worry, every reason to be, you know, to take that gun point at him absolutely as seriously as could be. Alejandro Natividad. That's as close as I can get, I'm sorry. But anyway, Will Grigg is right. That is some Tiananmen Square tank stand down type heroics right there. That's brave. No, I'm not going to lay down. And I don't know, Will Grigg quoted him, but maybe I missed it. Did he actually say, if you're going to kill me, I'm not going to be laying on the ground, I'm going to be standing up? Something along those lines. Obviously, he decided that. It's a brave man. They arrested him, they released him. They didn't have any charges on him. Alejandro Natividad. I wonder if I could get him on the show, man. That's cool. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Trita Parsi on Iran and their nuclear program. Here's a little bit of news. Where to begin?
Here's some good news. In Tunisia, guess what? They had an election. And guess what happened? The Islamists lost. And the secular party won. And then guess what happened? The Islamist party said, hey, congratulations, guys. You won. And then they got out of the way. And then, yeah, maybe they'll go back and forth again. Democracy sucks, don't get me wrong. But it's a hell of a lot better than military dictatorship and blood flowing in the streets all the time, right? So that's pretty good. Let's see what happens in Tunisia there. I admit, I haven't been following it closely enough, but it's there in the top headlines at antiwar.com today. Tunisian Islamists. Oh, it's a Reuters piece. Tunisian Islamists concede election defeat to secular party. All right. Well, all right, so there's that. That's all I know about it, so that's all I got to say about that. Ukraine had a vote. The pro-Western parties, of course, won because the East wasn't involved. And I am under the impression the Radical Party and the Svoboda Party will be in the parliament. And they actually did better than the gas princess Yulia Tymoshenko's Fatherland Party. Not that she's a fascist or anything. Fatherland. Who are these kooks, dude? Oh, they're a bunch of nationalists. That's when you're being polite. National socialists when you're not. Oh, there's my long-lost Afghan war article from the first segment that I couldn't find about NATO vowing long-term air support for Afghan war. Yeah, it's going to take more than that. Anyway. And then this is bad news. Feds identify suspected second leaker for Snowden reporters. The FBI recently searched a government contractor's home, but some officials worry the Justice Department has lost its appetite for leak cases. Way to represent the government's point of view there, Michael Isikoff. So you've heard Greenwald say, and other people have figured out, that there's another source here for some of this NSA stuff. It's not coming from Snowden. Well, apparently they've got him. I guess we'll see what happens there. That's Michael Isikoff writing for Yahoo News. An original for Yahoo News by Michael Isikoff, huh? I didn't realize that. So, yeah, it's Scahill had that watch list. That's one of the things that apparently came from this second source. Was the terrorist watch list. All right, so there's that. You can find that at antiwar.com, too. And then last Saturday, did you see antiwar.com? Last Saturday, 716 people were killed in fighting across Iraq, according to Margaret Griffith's count for antiwar.com. On Saturday, it was another 238. And I'm sorry, actually, here, let me get the yesterday numbers for you. May they be lower. 317 killed on Monday. Bombers attack civilian and security targets across Iraq. 317 killed. So there's the war in Iraq raging again. there's a question about whether the Peshmerga are going from Iraqi Kurdistan to go and help bail out the YPG. There's also a question, according to Lande's reporting and McClatchy, there's a real question raised by this new propaganda video. Have you guys seen this video? This poor bastard, the British guy that they've had give these lectures where he cites Michael Scheuer and all this stuff. Well, his name is John Cantilli, and he's a Brit, and he's a hostage of the Islamic State, and they have him hosting a propaganda video like he's a CNN reporter, broadcasting live, or not live, but broadcasting from Kobani, and saying, yeah, there's no YPG anywhere around here. I mean, we're just mopping up now, but the battle is won, and contrary to all your propaganda, he says, he's got a gun to his head, so you can't blame him. But Lande says, hey, you know, I think he's onto something here, that there's real reason to doubt that there's much of a YPG, Kurdistan Workers Party force left there in Kobani at this point. And I don't know exactly what the truth of it is. I don't think the entire city has fallen. And I don't know the degree to which the Turks are letting people in right now. They've gone back and forth on that. And, you know, have at different times let people in and turn them away. But, you know, that footage includes ISIS drone footage from over Kobani. Of, looks like an empty town. And as the prisoner says, narrating, see? Everybody already fled. The town belongs to us. Anyway, so that's Lande at McClatchy, D.C. on, I don't know. I really don't know the truth of it. I don't know if anybody knows the truth of who's how far ahead there. But then, oh, here's another thing I wanted. There's a, well, a Kurdish oil article. Everybody already knows about that, right? I wanted to point this out. Ali Soufan, he's an FBI agent from the early terror war days. And I always did mean to read his book. I don't even have it on the to-read pile, I don't think. The Ali Soufan book. But anyway, he's the guy that was winning Abu Zubaydah over with cookies and cool water to drink before the CIA ever even started torturing him. Anyway, I'm not saying he's a great guy, but he was a FBI counterterrorism guy going back to the 90s and stuff. So now he's out of government. He has this thing called the Soufan Group. And, yeah, he's a former FBI counterterrorism agent. It's not like he's some libertarian analyst. I'm not saying that. But so there's the background on who he is and what he's about, I think. And you can read all about him, actually. He's been written about at length by other authors and so forth because he's a big part of the torture story. But anyway, so from Buka to Kobani, the hybrid ideology of the Islamic State. And this is about how, man, I really need to, remember to put this in the story when I tell it, because it's such a huge, important part of the story, that during the occupation of Iraq, right during the El Salvador option time, of Rumsfeld's greatest backing for the Bada Brigade in the Civil War there, at the beginning of that whole policy. All these guys were prisoners together, Baathists and Bin Ladenites. They were held and I don't know how badly tortured there at Camp Buka for years. And that's where they came together, and that's why it's half Bin Ladenism and half Baathist military strategy working together to forge this Islamic State right now, which is why it's so much more formidable than the old AQI. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hang on, I'm trying to reach Trita. There guess it's not going to work. Okay, what the hell does it mean that I call both of this guy's numbers? I have a dial tone out. I just talked to Will Grigg earlier. That wasn't Skype. That was the phone. I got a dial tone out. Both of Trita Parsi's numbers, I call them. I get nothing. No busy signal. No ring. No nothing. No voicemail. No nothing. What's that? I think that might be a first for me. I've had error messages in all kinds of languages I could never learn, but I think that's the first time I've called two different numbers. I did the 1 and the 202 and all the rest of it, right? No. Not even a ring. Here. Hey, try again. There you go. That was enough beeps. Yep. See? It's not even ringing. Alright, well, whatever, because I had a bunch more stuff to talk about, too, so. I guess we're going to figure out the mystery of Trita Parsi's telephones later on. Some other time? This is going to really bother my brain for a while now. I bet someone a lot dumber than me already knows what the answer is, right? And I just can't think of it because nobody knows why. All right, well, good. So back to what I was talking about then, because this is really interesting to me. I hope you'd read it. The hybrid ideology of the Islamic State. The hybrid ideology is they have the statism, the military professionalism, the fascism of the Ba'ath Party, mixed with the bin Ladenism, if you could call it that, of these Takfiri kookies, the bin Ladenites, the Ayman al-Zawahiriites. Oh, no, they're broken off from Al-Qaeda now, but they're the same exact thing anyway. And the thing is, it should go without saying, but I'll go ahead and make sure. There was no relationship between Saddam and Osama. Between the Iraqi government and Al-Qaeda is just a bunch of crap. The CIA themselves have completely disavowed that because it's just not true. Never was true. Now it's true. If Bush had said, Saddam, I'll hire you and your sons to kill jihadists. Let's keep them the hell out of, you know, help Iran keep them bottled up in Afghanistan. Right? He would have done it. He had no interest in working with those kooks whatsoever. So anyway, al-Duri and a few of the other former leaders of the Ba'ath Party, and they say about al-Duri that he was already kind of leaning a little bin Ladenite. He's a perfect fit for these guys. And they all sat in prison together during the Iraq War occupation, and that's where the nucleus of this group was formed, and that's what they are referring to here as their hybrid ideology. They're Islamo-fascists. Ha! Just like in all the ridiculous propaganda that was not true 10 years ago. Oh, we're fighting the Islamo-fascists. No, you're forging Islamo-fascists, I said. See? Here we are. Islamo-fascists forged. And they even have their own state now. As he says here, the result is an extremist group unlike any other. It's the merging of Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. Right, even though they're both dead. It's only the wars that have raged in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and especially in Iraq and Syria that's made it this way. And you know what? Here's a fun counterfactual I don't think I ever really explored out loud on the show anyway, and that would be, so what if all of Bush Cheney, you know, Bush Jr., Cheney administration, what if all that was all just, yeah, take it for granted? But what if Obama had never backed? What if he had even gotten the troops out just like in George Bush's and Nouri al-Maliki's timetable? But what if he had never backed the jihad in Libya and in Syria at all? I wonder how different things would be. I think, here's what I think would have happened. I think Assad, and, you know, that would have to include, doing everything he could to force the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris to stop backing the jihad in Syria, too. But if that was the hypothetical there, I think Assad, he would have killed the rebellion. It would have died at the by the end of 2011, and it would be sad, and then, but that would be it. There'd be no al-Nusra front. There'd be no Islamic State. They'd have been lined up and shot. And then to what degree would the Islamic State have risen up in Western Iraq under Baghdadi's leadership to fight against Maliki? Maybe to a degree. Maliki was, you know, basically doing everything he could to provoke such a situation. I think at first, unintentionally, although, you know, carelessly enough. And then later, hey, it was good politics to be the defender of the Shia since they were the only ones voting. And hey, can't change streams, can't change horses in midstream. Jesus, I can't get a cliche right to save my life today, can I? Maybe I shouldn't speak in cliches. Oh, yeah, no, I was mocking the cliches that others use. You can't change your leadership in the middle of a conflict. That's the American way. Everybody knows that. So anyway, that was what Maliki was betting on. And it worked for him. He got reelected, but then he lost a war immediately thereafter, and so that undid him. Unlike in America, where you can lose wars, it's fine. They just keep losing them, and nobody holds them accountable. They keep starting them and losing them. Anyway, so go read that. It's at the Soufan Group, soufangroup.com, from Buka. That's Camp Buka prison to Kobani, Syria. The hybrid ideology of the Islamic State. Interesting read. That's all I'm saying. Oh, see the American 14-year-old killed by Israeli troops in the West Bank. I got to interview somebody about that. I don't know enough about that. I want to know a lot about that. 14-year-old born in New Orleans. But has lived in the West Bank since he was 6. Uh-oh. You know, every minute he was living over there, his humanity from being born in New Orleans was dripping away. So it could be now that, and especially since he was murdered by an Israeli government employee, he might as well have been black from Missouri and shot by a cop, right? Does he have any rights that any Israeli is bound to respect, even if he is born in New Orleans, right? Hell, you might as well be black from New Orleans. As long as I'm making metaphors and analogies and stuff. He's an Arab in the occupied territory. What right does he have to not be killed by a IDF soldier? Apparently none. Oh, the Americans, why, they're insisting on an investigation. So don't worry then. All right. And then... Oh, there's a big thing about... the sneak and peek warrants at EFF. I want to get somebody on about this. I write into my notes for later. The Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's about the sneak and peek warrants as part of the Patriot Act. We talk about 215 for tapping your phone, Section 215. Section 213 lets them break into your house when you're not there. And instead of remember on TV, if it's never happened to you, I hope. But you see on TV, somebody comes home and there's a note on the table that says, here. It's an order from a judge saying we could search your house, and we did. And here's what we took, even. They don't have to do that anymore. And according to the EFF, they're using it all the time. 47 times in quote-unquote terrorism cases. God damn it. That always happens. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. Hey, guess what's funny, guys? He could hear me. He was yelling, yeah, I'm here, hey! But anyway, well, I got him on the phone now, so that's good. It's Trita Parsi. He's the head of the National Iranian American Council. You could call him the peace lobby, focused on peace between America and Iran. And he's got a great stable of writers and activists over there and everything. Welcome back to the show, Trita. How are you?
Thanks so much, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Oh, it's NIACouncil.org, everybody. NIACouncil.org. Go there, read stuff. So you got this new one. It's in the Reuters here. Trita, how congressional hawks plan to kill Obama's Iran deal. Everybody, you can find it in the viewpoint section today on antiwar.com as well. How congressional hawks plan to kill Obama's Iran deal. So first, remind us again very quickly what Iran deal, and then we'll get to the hawks part.
So we're talking about the nuclear deal, the nuclear negotiations that are currently going on between the P5 plus one, the United States, Russia, China, the EU, and then on the other side, the Iranians. And they're actually making major progress right now, and there's some noise from some congressional quarters saying that, oh, you know, the president is going around Congress. Congress should have a right to say something about this or vote on this. And bottom line is Congress is going to vote on this at the end of the day, because part of the deal is going to be relief of sanctions that only Congress can decide on. But what they're actually doing is that they're trying to have an early vote as quickly as possible. And the reason why they're trying to do that is because they know that immediately after the deal, that's when the chances are the best of getting Congress to vote no and not go along with the deal. If the deal is permitted to last for a while, the Iranians start doing positive things and everyone is living up to their end of the bargain and things are actually working out, then guess what? Obama can come back to Congress and actually succeed in getting the sanctions lifted. And because they don't want the sanctions to get lifted, they don't want to have a peace, they want to drive this towards a military confrontation, they're calling for an early vote, using a lame excuse of constitutionality, saying that the Congress has a right to say something about this. And it's true, they do. It doesn't mean that they have a right to say something right away, though.
Yeah, well, and maybe they do, but I mean, the Senate has the right to either ratify it or not. They can try.
Well, no, that's if it's a treaty. That's if it's a treaty. The Senate has a right to ratify.
Oh, right.
A treaty.
Yeah, no, yeah.
This is
yeah,
not
right.
A treaty.
It's only about repealing the sanctions, is all.
Exactly.
Right. So, all right. Well, so, but in other words, they're not really doing anything outside of their authority. They're just being real jerks when we're right on the eve of something that could be a very.
Well, I mean, the disingenuous argument is to say that the president is trying to go around the Congress. He's not. The issue is, though, that the deal specifically says that sanctions are not going to get lifted until the Iranians have demonstrated that they can be trusted and that they're doing a couple of positive steps. If you're pushing for that vote to take place right away, you're actually doing what the Iranians want. The Iranians want the sanctions to be taken away right away. So the only reason they're pushing for an immediate response to this is because they know that they can't risk letting the deal work, because if the deal works, it's going to be so much tougher to pass anti-Iran legislation in Congress.
Right, I see. Well, now, I haven't been keeping up with this kind of stuff because mostly I don't care, Trita, but isn't it the case that everybody's saying... No, I don't mean the Iran stuff. I mean, I was going to say about the congressional elections, about whether the... Aren't they saying the Republicans are going to take the Senate this time? Does that make it worse?
I mean, look, there's new reports coming out on a daily basis, and more of them say that there's a very high likelihood that the Senate will fall into Republican control, which will make this more complicated, obviously.
Yeah. Well, it's just too bad that Obama won't, he doesn't seem to want to really make the case for this thing. I mean, he did shout the hawks down in Obama terms, you know, comparatively, heroically, he shouted them down in the State of the Union and said, I will veto any new sanctions. I'm not going to let you screw this thing up. We're at a delicate place in the thing, and it's my priority to negotiate it and butt out. And they did. And that was pretty good. But, you know, it seems like he could just make the case, or at least have his people make a stronger case for getting this thing through. He doesn't sound, it seems like, geez, he's taken it this far in the negotiations, it seems like, is really precedent-setting and humongous, and it must mean he's really committed to it. However, his public diplomacy here in America on behalf of the program politically, he just hasn't made the effort, it seems like.
I think you are absolutely right, and it's been a criticism that I've put forward as well. I can tell you the response from the White House is that until they have essentially a deal in hand or something very close to a deal in hand, they're not going to go on a selling campaign. They want to be as close to an actual deal as possible before they go down that route. And you know what, Scott? Last Thursday, they started selling the deal, which I assume means that they're very, very close to having a deal. Because for the first time, Wendy Sherman gave a major speech at CSIS, and she was now much more forward-leaning, pointing out that those who had argued against diplomacy were wrong. The world is in a better place now because of the negotiations, and the Iranians are living up to the end of the bargain, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that what you call for and what I've also called for actually is starting to take place right now.
Yeah. And now I saw where your colleague Reza Marashi was arguing on Twitter there saying that, you know, what we could do, it's the same thing we did with the interim deal, which is say, you know what, we agree on A through F, and so that's good. And then everything else we'll just call technical details as long as we have a firm handshake that we really mean to work these details out. And in the case of the nuclear, in case of the interim deal, that's exactly what happened. And they did work those details out, and everything has been hunky-dory, as you just said. So do you think that they can do that, that they can get, I don't know, 75% of a deal, call it a deal, and then work out the rest, something like that, if they have to?
I'm not so sure they can do that, but it is definitely true that they can agree on the principles of the deal, essentially on the deal itself, and then they leave the schedule and timetable of the implementation to technical negotiations that will continue after the deal has been signed. That's exactly what happened last time. They had a deal, they had a principle, everything was settled, but who's going to take what step first at what time and what's the deadline? That was hashed out for another 2.5 months after that deal was signed. Mm-hmm. That same thing can happen. The reason why they want to avoid this happening is very simple. During those two or whatever months it will take to hash out the schedule, the deal is very vulnerable. And that's when congressional hawks can do a lot of damage.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny that it's really kind of paradoxical that I think I saw Stephen Walt point this out on his blog a few months back, that the people who want the deal the most are the ones who know good and well that Iran isn't making nukes and aren't even concerned about Iran making nukes. They just see this, people like you and me, we see this as, you know, the gigantic outstanding issue, whatever the truth behind it is, it's the gigantic outstanding issue that serves as the excuse to perpetuate this terrible Cold War between America and Iran. And, you know, we absolutely have to get it out of the way. On the other hand, if they can't work it out right now, really the only problem is, like you're saying, politically, it'll make it more difficult to get it done later on, that kind of thing. But there still really is no – they would have to have some kind of argument for war other than just the talks didn't work. When everyone agrees, including all the intelligence agencies still and all the major newspaper writers, even David Sanger, that there is no secret program and there's no indication they're diverting uranium or working on a nuclear bomb. At the most, they have a couple of technical questions they say haven't been all the way answered yet, this kind of thing. But there really is no heat toward war with Iran on this issue right now. And we could work it out in a few years still and it would be all right, right?
I think so. I mean, you're right in the sense that this really has been a devastating conflict, and they need to get this out of the way, and there's, to some extent, less than meets the eye. If this is taken out of the way, there's a lot of opportunities that emerge, a lot of interesting things that can happen. I don't think the United States would have to be as involved militarily in the Middle East. For instance, the Iranians could take care of large parts of ISIS and not necessitate American involvement. But none of that is now feasible because they haven't managed to solve this issue yet. So that's the hurdle that has to be passed first.
Yeah. Well, and I'm all for it. I can't believe, actually, that it's been this difficult. And I think, you know, the congressional leaders, their staffs, they understand this issue well enough that if they were trying to back the president on this very, very hard, they could make some pretty powerful statements in favor of this deal and I think, you know, help neutralize the push against it. Because you know how it is, for better or for worse, mostly only for worse, but sometimes for better too, politics stops at the water's edge. And the Republicans especially, you know, they respect the power of the president to decide these kinds of issues, or at least to have his chance to negotiate these kinds of things. So, you know, I don't know. I'm still optimistic about it, Trita. I hope you
are. Me too. I think something good is going to happen.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your time. It's great
talking to you again.
Appreciate it.
Talk to you soon. Thanks. Bye.
All right, Shell, that's Trita Parsi. He's at the National Iranian American Council. The Reuters piece here is how congressional hawks plan to kill Obama's Iran deal. See you tomorrow.